This is the sound of a doomed highway, recorded in 2008. It's the Alaskan Way Viaduct in Seattle. For anybody who's arrived in Seattle in the past 10 years or so, you might not know what I'm talking about when I say those four words, the Alaskan Way Viaduct. So I'll tell you. The Alaskan Way Viaduct was a double-decked highway running north-south along Seattle's waterfront. And when it opens in 1952, it's a kind of technological marvel of its time. It's a manifestation in concrete and rebar of Seattle's arrival as a space-age city and a space-age nation. It's a symbol of modernity. It's also just a highway. And looking at old images of it when it opened, which you can see on historylink.org, and even images when it was being built, the viaduct has a brutal elegance about it. And a certain, to my eyes anyway, a certain film noirish sense of dread. It's a smooth highway, precision engineered to fit into a very narrow space in the city, and to carry motorists in a heady zoom past the downtown buildings, above the city itself, from A to B, with no thought really to who or what is in between or down below. So it's dreamed of for decades, the Alaskan Way Viaduct. It's constructed mostly in the 1950s and the early 1960s. And by 2001, it's starting to show its age. And then this happens.
A strong earthquake shook Seattle and other parts of the Pacific Northwest today. Local hospitals are reporting at least 12 people were...
And after this, it's clear the viaduct's days are numbered. And the last of it is dismantled in 2019. It's gone. Where the viaduct once dominated the waterfront in Seattle, today there's a new multi-lane surface road, a new cycle track, a renovated ferry terminal, an overlook walk, about which more in a minute, a reconnected Pike Place Market, a rejuvenated aquarium, and a 1.7-mile long tunnel. That's a lot of stuff. How did that even happen? How did we get from this?
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Governor Chris Gregoire and Seattle Mayor Greg Nickels probably aren't going to be exchanging Valentine cards today. Nickels and most of the Seattle City Council members want a tunnel to replace the Alaskan Way Viaduct. But yesterday, Governor Gregoire and state legislative leaders said the tunnel plan is dead.
To this.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. This morning, King County Executive Ron Sims and Governor Chris Gregoire announced an agreement to drill a deep bore tunnel under First Avenue to replace the Alaskan Way Viaduct on Seattle's waterfront.
That's what this series is about. From historylink.org, this is an eight-year-long emergency. Seattle, an earthquake, and a doomed waterfront highway. I'm Dominic Black, and this is episode one, A Contested Waterfront. So where to begin? Kiku Hughes is my co-host for this series. She works for History Link. She's a comic book artist and she's the author of the graphic novel Displacement, a beautiful and haunting piece of work. She's also the illustrator of Those Who Helped Us, assisting Japanese Americans during the war, with author Ken Mochizuki.
So in this series, we'll be trying to untangle how all of this came about. And we'll be chatting with many of the people directly involved in shaping how it happened. And we'll be looking at it all through the lens of Seattle's waterfront history.
So it's only 170 years or so since the founding of the non-native city that would become Seattle. The blink of an eye, really, the blink of an eye, in a region where human history dates back at least 14,000 years.
And one idea animated that founding.
This is not Massachusetts in the 1620s.
Empire.
This is not California in the 1720s. This is the 1850s. This is the height of empire. This is the height of colonialism in its industrial forms. So it arrives in the form of things like logging camps and fish canneries and so on. So it's already industrial when it arrives here.
Carl Thrush is the author of native Seattle, histories from the crossing over place. And he's going to be our guide through a lot of this episode, because understanding what's actually the really very short history of white encounters with Indigenous people in Seattle and how we talk about them offers us a way of looking at power and how we talk about and make decisions and how we shape a city. It gives us a view of our own brief sliver of time and an opportunity to reflect on what we're doing in the here and now.
I think it's really important to understand that in Indigenous language in the Puget Sound area, north, south, east, and west are not as important as toward the shore, away from the shore, upriver, downriver, and so on. So places like waterfronts are absolutely central to everything. And we really see that with the paddling journeys that have happened in recent years, where coming ashore is really the moment.
We talk about the waterfront as being many different places at the same time, and that changes over time, but it always means different things to different people.
Jennifer Ott is an environmental historian. She's the executive director of HistoryLink, and she's the author of the new book, Where the City Meets the Sound, The Story of Seattle's Waterfront.
It depends on what shoes you're in. It depends on what vessel you're in. All of the different things that bring you to the waterfront really shape what your understanding of the place is and your connection to the place. And I don't know if that's always true, but it feels unique to Seattle's waterfront that it really means so much, that is very drastically different depending on who you are and what point in time you're talking about.
An image that has worked really well for me over the years is the idea of the palimpsest, which is essentially a medieval manuscript that has had layers of text written over each other. Sometimes the earlier texts are erased, but you can still see them under ultraviolet light or whatever. So the past is never past. The landscape is a palimpsest with all these different layers coming through. And one of the things that I've been really grateful for being able to do this research is to be able to move through a place like Seattle and understand that there are layers in this place.
If you go down to the new Seattle waterfront today, you'll see this sweeping promenade in concrete, the Overlook Walk as it's called, that connects down from Pike Place Market westwards over the several lanes of traffic and all the way down, down, down to sea level, where Jennifer Ott and me met Valerie Segrist, who's a member of the Muckleshoot tribe. Valerie's a nutritionist. A lot of her work centers on community and food sovereignty. And she's been designing the landscape of native plants on the Overlook Walk. We met her at the new beach that's been created as part of the waterfront rejuvenation. It's a little rocky beach down between Pier 48 and Coleman Dock, right at the foot of Washington Street.
Walk is, I was really inspired by how you can stand on a clear summer day, right, in Seattle and see these beautiful mountain ranges, from Whitecap, you know, top of Tahoma, all the way to the Whitecap, the waters that we see right here in the Salish Sea. So the inspiration is Whitecap to Whitecap and all of the ecosystems that exist along the way. And one of the things we think about in this area is, you know, there's these keystone species like cedar trees and salmon and clams and huckleberry, you know, but in between there's this incredible breadth of diversity that has in and of itself its own way of showing us how to be in the world. And so those ecosystems are really designed to help us think about the cultural context, centering culture in the ecosystem. They're called cultural ecosystems, which simply means like Coast Salish ancestors and people today are interacting with these ecosystems as if they were gardens, as if they were Mr. McGregor's garden. You know, we're pruning, we're coppicing, we're fertilizing, we're reseeding, we're replanting, we're thinking about how we can intervene in the system to create abundance. That's what a cultural ecosystem is really about. And so the whole Overlook Walk is supposed to take you through that experience of starting from Whitecap at a saltwater beach, moving you through berry thickets and gardens, all the way through wetland ecosystems, which was incredibly complex to think about on a rooftop, and then all the way into old growth and high mountain meadows, so that you can stand in those areas and look at the mountain and see kind of what you would see if you were in the mountain, or you can look at the water and see what you would see if you're on a saltwater beach. And, you know, one of the things that came out later on with this project that sort of struck me is the oculus that sits underneath the Overlook Walk, where, you know, it's sort of meant to be like make the aquarium available for all. Anybody who walks by is going to be able to look up into, you know, a tank of the aquarium. But that oculus design is such a critical shape in Southern Coast Salish artwork. It is the circle. We have, you know, circle, trigons, and crescents, and some say extended trigons as well. And those three shapes can be found everywhere in nature, right? And they are not meant to be stagnant shapes. They are meant to embody life. And so that oculus design that just like organically emerged in these, you know, these plans for the aquarium's new addition, and the fact that the Indigenous Design Work Group was such a central part of developing and shaping what that looked like has been powerful to me. The oculus, or the Coast Salish eye, represents watching and witnessing, you know, from the past to the present, all the way into the future. It is an active eye, it's an active oculus, and to have this Overlook Walk sort of be, you know, sheltering it like its eyelid is just incredible to me to think about. So, oh, and it's like Princess Angeline's front door, right? It's her front door. Like, I've designed gardens before, but this one was like, oh my gosh, I'm designing it for this iconic person that had such a special place in people's hearts in the city and still does.
Yeah, the placement is pretty fascinating.
Yeah, all the stuff that came up out of it, just sort of, it's like the land was waiting to tell a story here on the waterfront, and we created space for that to happen by including, you know, our voices in that in that shaping of the future of the city. And that, I think, has had powerful effects that we won't even be able to measure until years from now.
Even though it's changed dramatically over time, repeatedly, you can still see traces and touch points of the past wherever you go on the waterfront. And you see that through the uses that people put certain spaces to. You can pull those all the way back to the past. The small boat landing at Washington Street is a great example. That goes back thousands of years as a place where small boats have landed on the central waterfront. And it's because of the topography and because of the location. But it's interesting that once a space sort of becomes useful in a certain way, we see on the waterfront over and over that that use pulls forward to the present. So you have both a connection to the past of that place, but also a connection to how it's evolved over time and what it will be going into the future.
When I was researching this series, I came across the etymology of the word waterfront that, as far as I can tell, comes from around 1766, although I'm not sure where. But I also came across the existence of a theme park attraction at Tokyo Disney Sea called American Waterfront, and it's modeled on an East Coast New York waterfront, vibrant with the spirit of new immigrants combined with a Cape Cod fishing town, if you can picture that. The excitement of the big city and the charms of a New England fishing village, I think it says on its website. And it got me wondering about the idea of an American waterfront. What does it signify? In this iteration, it represents something quintessentially American. It's a symbol, but it's an artifice too. It's an imitation, a simulacrum, an imagined version of a once real thing. And if you were going to dream up your own Seattle version of that imagined place, the perfect picture to hold in your mind's eye might be Murray Morgan's description of the Seattle waterfront in 1951 from his classic book, Skid Road, which Kiku Hughes is going to read.
To know Seattle, one must know its waterfront. It is a good waterfront, not as busy as New York's, not as self-consciously colorful as San Francisco's, not as exotic as New Orleans, but a good, honest, working waterfront with big gray warehouses and trim fishing boats and docks that smell of creosote and seagulls and tugs and seafood restaurants and beer joints and fish stores. A waterfront where you can hear foreign languages and buy shrunken heads and genuine stuffed mermaids, where you can watch the seamen follow the streetwalkers and the shore patrol follow the sailors, where you can stand at an open-air bar and drink clam nectar or sit on a deadhead and watch the water, or go to an aquarium and look at an octopus.
So Jennifer, you want to say something about this?
You could do an entire podcast on that quote. It captures both the reality of the waterfront at that time, but also it's just a snapshot of a waterfront that's passing away. At that exact moment, it is on its way out of being. And then also it just captures a very specific perspective on what a waterfront is and should be.
It's romantic, that vision. The rhythm of the prose is hypnotic, echoing the rhythm of the water as it laps around the foot of the piers. It's a waterfront that's a little bit rough and ready, but not too rough and ready. There's a hint of mischief, but not too much mischief. The streetwalkers and sailors and shore patrol are benign walk-on parts. It's very safe, this waterfront. It's from a simpler time, captured right before the Alaskan Way Viaduct was built. As we've been making this series, it's been amazing to me how many people brought up the vision for the new waterfront developed by the architect James Corner. He was all about drawing on that old Seattle as a working waterfront vibe. He really gets Seattle, people would say, the working class strand in the city's DNA, I think somebody called it. And I think the reason so many people were drawn to that vision is because it tells them a story about the city that they want to hear, that it's a city not completely sold out to money and capital and big tech, that it's a city where history still has meaning, that it's a city that still has an organic, beating, working class heart.
As you're saying this, I'm thinking of I think it was 1951, so right about the time that Murray Morgan was writing that, there is a documentary done on King 5, one of the first documentaries done by a local news station, and it's called Lost Cargo. And it's about how the waterfront is in danger of losing its jobs, because the port facilities are not keeping up with the changing times and we're losing the quantity of cargo. And the point is that it needs to be the break bulk cargo, which is the kind that you carry on and off the ships, not the grain or the oil that would be just siphoned into a tanker. And so the documentary is just full of anxiety about what is going to happen to these working class jobs, because those are what drive Seattle's economy. And the documentary talks about how the ripple effect of the economic benefits of cargo handling in Seattle. And it's really interesting because they wouldn't have been able to articulate it at the time, but the thing that's happening is that the world is changing, global trade is changing, and even though it seems like that is the identity of Seattle, it's unbelievable how small that slice of time is, right? It's about the 1850s is when we start handling lumber through the port, but it's very small scale. But like that large scale industrial cargo handling is really the 1880s to the 1950s when they're saying that. So that is just a glimpse of a moment in time that we were doing that, but there is a real anxiety that it's going away.
When I read Carl Thrush's book, Native Seattle, Histories from the Crossing Over Place, one of the ideas that comes up again and again is that the dominant storytelling about place in Seattle has Indians as belonging almost solely to the past. And I realized how challenging I find it not to fall into that way of thinking. So embedded has that story being in popular culture that I've been exposed to growing up in the north of Ireland, for goodness sake. And of course, I know that's not the truth, but it struck me that that's how the empire works, by embedding certain narratives and quote-unquote truths, certain stories, deep within you. So you don't even know they're there until you make an effort, a conscious effort, to interrogate them. That's how it works, empire. It's like being in the Catholic Church. Once in, never out.
I had a thought, I don't know if it's useful, but sort of what you're talking about, you know, this imagination of indigenous life as being in the past, you know, a big part of that, I think, is this insistence on this authenticity of what it was and what it is to be indigenous. And I think that is a big part of the misunderstanding that, you know, often white people have about culture, that it is sort of the static and there is an authentic part of that culture, and that if you deviate from that, you are no longer participating in the authentic part of that culture. Just a failure to acknowledge the change and the evolution of culture as the situation changes.
Is it in any way challenging to enter into a process like this with an open heart? You know what I mean?
First of all, I think it's really telling of our time that we are included in a planning process for the redesign. And when, you know, my experience and what I had heard at the time when the waterfront they just started breaking ground, was a lot of people in my community really predicting that it would be a check the box, you know, type of partnership or collaboration where we put some native plants in the ground, let's move on. But what has happened, I think, over the last couple of years is through trusting the process and people really showing up with an open heart and an open mind and accepting all different voices at the table. Like true collaboration has happened, and that is beautiful. There was a time when it was illegal for us to even live in the city of Seattle. That's why Muckleshoot has the zip code that it has, you know. And so for us to be invited to the table to help tell a story, and honestly, like our people are fishing those waters right now, tonight. My children and so many of the other folks on the Indigenous Work Group have said, we want our children to know that they belong here too. And that means that when we have the opportunity to make something recognizable and help them understand that this is their place also, we need to take that opportunity. And for so long, we've been in this like mode, survival mode, and now there is the time for healing. And decolonizing really means making the invisible visible. And that means that when we have a chance to be visible, we need to show up and recognize that as part of our healing process.
Was it difficult to convince community members of that?
I think at first, yeah. When I first started, you know, even talking about native plants, people in this community, and this is still ongoing to this very day, feel very protective of that. And there are many reasons why they should feel that way too. But, and when we start teaching these stories and creating places for people to share their gift and knowledge, we realize and recognize that that's where healing really happens, that people feel that they have a purpose in their community, that they have some something to share, and it's being received well, and people are excited about it, and they see the impacts on their life and how transformative food can be. It's sort of undeniable that that now is the time to be able to share that knowledge that's appropriate to share. So I often say, like, I think of plants as my best friends, And there are things about my best friends I would never share with anybody else. I wouldn't tell anybody, just her and I know this. And then there are things about her that I would tell the world because they may need a better understanding of her. And so that is the space that I work in when I'm talking about nettles or, you know, any native plant or food. That this is common knowledge, but I'm helping to connect the dots. There are moments I've had with those plants that are just for me and maybe for my daughters to learn someday when they're ready, you know.
If we experience the waterfront as many places, not just one, if we're sensitive to the layers of history and experience their echoes in that space, we eventually come up against the founding myth of white Seattle, the Denny Party story. You know, the settlers who arrive in Alki by boat from Portland. It's raining, it's miserable, it's cold, and after a season there, they move across the water, and they dig holes, and they build houses, and they build churches and general stores, and they persevere, and they triumph. That's the story. It's one story.
And then in terms of how a story like the Denny Party at Alki gets traction and becomes kind of the founding myth of the city, has a lot to do not with the 1850s, but with the late 19th and early 20th century, when the children that were born to the Denny Party really start establishing a historical canon in the city that, you know, we were the founders.
This idea of a singular first encounter, a switching on of the present, like you'd switch on a light, it does a really important job. It establishes your history, your right to be there, your bona fides, because you were there when it all began, which was 1851, obviously.
Often what they're doing is they're setting themselves in contrast to all the newcomers to Seattle, sort of the new urban Seattle that's coming, and all the sort of pioneer generation is dying away, and their children are really saying, no, we were the real settlers. These newcomers, they don't have to work for it. We are the real settlers. And one of the ways they do that is by talking about their proximity to indigenous people.
Cut out a clearing from a dense forest on a side hill, 1 mile long and a quarter of a mile wide, put about 50 houses in this clearing. Divide the settlement into two streets filled with sawdust. Give the place 3 hotels, 5 boarding houses, and 17 grog shops, and you have a clear idea of Seattle, said one observer in the 1850s.
There's a really interesting conundrum for early settlers in the village of Seattle, what's called the village period, up until the 1880s, really, where it's very clear that settlers like the Dennys and the Borens and the Bells don't want indigenous people there. And in fact, one of the first ordinances passed in the town is an ordinance that says that indigenous people cannot live within the city limits. But there's an exemption if they're employed and put up by white people. And so indigenous people are working in the mills, they're working as domestic laborers, they're transporting the mail. They're super important to the early economy of the town. And so there's this tension. The settlers both need them and don't want them at the same time. And so that produces a really interesting tension in which people are living, because this isn't how it was supposed to go. This was supposed to be a white settlement, a little piece of New England or the Midwest, on Puget Sound. But when people traveled there, the children all spoke Deutsch and Chinook Wawa, the two languages that you would have heard in town in addition to English. A lot of families of mixed ancestry. This was not how it was supposed to work out. And that's because of indigenous labor and indigenous commitment to staying in the places where the town was growing up.
And I think it's really worth taking a minute to let this sink in. One of the first ordinances passed, the first order of business in the city of Seattle, is to get rid of the indigenous population. And that's one of the most arresting moments for me in Cole Thrush's book, is this opening line that states an obvious truth so easily overlooked. Every American city is built on Indian land, but few advertise it like Seattle.
The process by which land is taken in what becomes Seattle has everything to do with what's called the cadastral survey, which is the creation of the township and range grids on the land that we still, our property regimes are still based upon those today. When you get a legal description of your plot of land in Wedgwood or White Center or whatever, the legal description tells you which township and range you're part of. So that goes back to the 1850s, and of course earlier than that in other places. It's really a sort of Jeffersonian ideal in a lot of ways, this kind of ordering of the landscape.
You see it all across the United States, and I think this is true anywhere that was colonized by non-Native people, is that they laid their city over an existing city, right? People had been living here for thousands of years. And so it's a natural fit for building a city, even though it's challenging with the hills. There's a lot of reason why it already, they knew it would work as a city because it has all the elements that they needed.
So, which are?
Well, they looked at it and saw the deep water harbor so they could get sailing ships in, has a forest absolutely blankets the hillside, so they know they have all that timber that they can export to San Francisco, which is in desperate need of it. And they know that there are fish in the water that they can sell in distant markets. And they suspect that there will be coal in the foothills. And so they know that they can export that. That's needed for steam engines up and down the coast. And then they also know that there will be river valleys where people can build farms. And so it's a remarkable meeting of resources next to a deep water harbor that is, they know that it's going to be successful. They know it's going to be hard to do what they're doing. They don't think it's going to be easy, but they do know it will be successful.
When Arthur Denny was in Illinois, he was a surveyor. I was going to say surveyors were the foot soldiers of empire, but actually foot soldiers were the foot soldiers of empire, because empire is always about violence in the pursuit of wealth. And surveyors make it happen on the ground. They're part of the machinery. They're out tramping around with wagons and chains, measuring off boundaries and marking them on charts and making maps. And it's this fascinating administrative process, the ink on the paper, the meaning of ownership.
So the land is taken, but it is not a clean cut then and now sort of situation. The city absolutely relies on Native people to get its economy started and to even survive here. And so what you have is you have that ordinance to push Indigenous people out. It's not reinstated when the city reincorporates. And so what you have instead is more of a series of actions that push Native people out. However, this place is important to Native people, and they have reasons of their own that they want to stay here. They want to interact with the city's economy. And so what we see happening is that a little piece of land starts jutting out. It builds out from the shoreline right at Washington Street, and it's built out of ballast dropped from ships. They are coming into Seattle with empty holds because there isn't much of a market here for goods, and so they have ballast to keep the boat stable. They dump it right next to the Oregon Improvement Company's dock, and it starts to build what is known as Ballast Island, even though it's really a peninsula of land jutting out from the shoreline. And that is where Native people create space for themselves within this new city, and they are tolerated. It's a complicated relationship with that space, but it is a place where they can maintain their presence in the city of Seattle and be part of the economy here. And it goes on from about the 1870s to the 1890s, and then the city grows over it and subsumes it, and then it disappears.
Where do the people go?
The people that were using Ballast Island are pushed out of the city in the 1890s, and they go to various places depending on their family connections and sort of their choices that they make for what jobs they're going to take to replace.
And what's the mechanism by which people are pushed?
People are pushed out in a variety of ways. There's the social way where they're just simply not welcomed. There's the actual burning of the longhouses. The last documented burning is in 1893 out in West Seattle. And then there is the discrimination of not being able to get a job or not being able to rent a home or buy a home. And so you have this disbursement that is a million small actions. It's never in Seattle that there's one moment that Indigenous people are displaced. It's a million small actions that make this space inhospitable for Native people. That doesn't mean that they actually leave, however, that there is no point in Seattle's history where Native people are not part of the community and not part of the city's identity and how the community develops.
I think the early settlers of Seattle absolutely saw themselves as participating in something that would be described in the day as manifest destiny. The idea that there's a preordained shining sea kind of teleology that is inevitable. I think they absolutely saw themselves as part of that. When you start to see the pioneer descendants writing up stories, as well as more newcomers to Seattle writing up stories of the city in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, they absolutely use the language of empire, whether it's referring to East Asia or it's referring to Alaska, the idea that Seattle now has empires. And so that language absolutely gets used, and it's about modernity. We're moving forward into the future, and Indigenous people are increasingly portrayed as relics of the past, if they're portrayed at all.
The early years of the white settler town were characterized by a waterfront that was a liminal space. This was a town in constant negotiation with the tides and the sea. And then there was the Gold Rush of 1897.
There had been a couple of waves of growth in Seattle's history by that point, but the Klondike Gold Rush is when we get this massive influx of people who come to Seattle to stay, not just pass through on their way to the Klondike. So the key to being ready for the Gold Rush is that we needed to have railroads connecting Seattle with the interior and the East Coast and the Midwest and all of the industrial centers there. And so you have the establishment in 1887 of Railroad Avenue, which is essentially just a right-of-way along the waterfront where the railroads can move north and south along the pier line. And then in 1893, we get the Great Northern Railroad establishes its terminus here in Seattle, which is our first transcontinental railroad terminus. And then after that, you have a series of events. So you have the establishment of regular service between the U.S. and Japan that comes through Seattle with the NYK line in 1896. And then you have the Gold Rush. And after that, the momentum continues to grow and more railroads come to serve Seattle. And that's what makes it possible for this to be a port city.
And what's going out and coming in?
It's amazing the variety of things going in and out of the city. Going out are primarily natural resources, things like salmon, timber, coal, things that can be extracted from the environment here. The things that are coming in are this amazing array of global goods. You have rubber, you have raw silk, you have oils, cooking oils from Asia.
Tea.
So much tea is coming through. It's amazing. Chests of tea are coming through and bales of silk. And then you see indigo, the dyes that come in. You see the pelts that come in from Alaska. It's remarkable how many skins come in from animals that have been trapped in Alaska. And you see going out, another thing that's very interesting is after the Gold Rush, massive amounts of milk and butter go out of Seattle because they cannot develop dairy herds in Alaska for environmental reasons. And so you have to supply that sort of basic human need because once again, it's not that the colonizers of Alaska adapt to the landscape and the food ways of the people who have lived there for generations. They instead import the thing that they're familiar with. And so they go to the effort to bring butter and milk and eggs north to Alaska through the Seattle port. I just think it's remarkable the effort that people will take to recreate the place they know. when you come to the Seattle waterfront, either for work or just in your life, what do you remark upon, even if it's just to yourself, or what do you notice and what do you think about?
This place always brings up memories, and I think that's such a gift to have. And the memories for me are, you know, the ones that we're creating in the current time. My family fishes right off the water here, and so we dock our boat on a slip just right up the road from here at Bell Street Harbor. And I think about how we, you know, me, my partner, my children, how we're on and off that boat, and there are so many celebrations to have in that moment. And then I'm reminded of, you know, when I was a teenager and I would come here and sort of wander the streets and feel this, just such a good presence of community and vibrancy in the downtown area. And then I'm just like also taken back even farther to a village site and just this, you know, undeniable presence of an ancestor walking with me along the waterfront and how they might have seen the world. And I think that's really important to sort of have that deep sense of place through these memories that are just both of a distant past and a very present future, that we're creating these memories today, that it's just such a deeply human experience. And I'm inspired by the built environment of the waterfront all the time.
What do you think of the new beach?
It's almost like this liberation has happened, you know? It feels like, hello, this is that distant memory. This is that distant memory that here we are recreating and reclaiming this space. And plants draw us to that all the time. The land draws us to that. The water does. Those are forces that we have had sacred relationships with since time began and developed over time. And here we are sort of re-sparking that. You know, never before in human history have we been removed. And it has been through recent changes in very urban environments like Seattle, where those spaces like this beach have been capped off and sort of hidden. And now we're sort of reclaiming that. I think as, you know, as a native person whose ancestral village is from this area, that means so many things. And also for people who are visiting here, if we can demonstrate to people what it means to get reconnected to place and reclaim a sense of where we are in the world and how we might show up in that space in a good way, then we've done our job here, you know, telling that story on the waterfront.
Imagine you're standing on today's waterfront in Seattle, and you have salt water on one side and hills and the city on the other. Maybe you're down south by Coleman Dock where the ferries come in, and you're looking north. Or maybe you're up north by the Pike Place Market on the Overlook Walk, and you're looking south. And imagine what you're seeing as if it's a film. Then run that film backwards, watch in your mind's eye, in that movie, as the viaduct creaks back into existence bit by bit, like some reverse-engineered Frankenstein's monster. Wind your movie back through the teens and the 2010s, and then the 1990s, 1980s, 1970s. You can see the viaduct as it used to be, with its roar and its dust and its rattles and its debris and its stubborn, inscrutable presence. Back through the 1960s, when the movie is turning to an autumnal whiskey-coloured amber document the way old film does, and back to black and white, the post-war 1950s, as a viaduct disappears again, bit by bit, when the waterfront becomes a series again of crowded streets and railroad lines and teeming wharves and warehouses. And keep on spooling back to when the streets are platforms made of timber plankings set on pilings, with the tides advancing and receding beneath. Or further back again to when the indigenous peoples of the Pacific Northwest first lived here, long before the arrival of white invaders, And this space was vital, as it is today, for trade and community and ceremony and life. So this is the waterfront in Seattle. This is where you can find those layers of history, where you can feel them if you take the time. It's the space where so many lives have played out and continue to play out. So many people from so many places moving through east, west, north, south, for trading, for work, for community, for family, for connection, for fun. It's the space where Chin Ching Hock arrives from San Francisco and opens the Hua Chong Company General Merchandise Store on December the 15th, 1868, selling tea, rice, coffee, flour, fireworks, and contract laborers. It's a space where Henry Yesler has his famous mill, largely worked by indigenous laborers. It's the same space where Mariners fans stream off the ferries in May with a spring in their step and trudge weary homewards in September. Where the trivial and the tragic play out side by side, where there's an effort to expel Chinese residents in 1886, and where there's a pretty good Filipino restaurant sometime in the 1970s, somewhere down in one of those piers that nobody can seem to quite remember. It might not feel like it's the same space, but it's the same space, that narrow stretch along the western edge of what's now the settled city, reclaimed from the sea, where you can stand on the overlook walk, watching the locals, watching the tourists, or sit in a park bench and watch the water, or visit the aquarium and look at an octopus. And where, in 2001, the Alaskan Way Viaduct starts to lean ever so slightly and settle ever so slightly as the earth in which it's suspended begins to move. Next time on An 8-Year Long Emergency, Seattle, an earthquake, and a doomed waterfront highway.
I was actually across the street in the Westin Hotel having coffee with a friend, and the chandelier started swaying, and then all the dishes in the cafe started flying off the walls. And I grew up in California, so my immediate thought was, oh my God, earthquake.
This podcast is possible thanks to the generous support of our sponsors, the Washington State Department of Archaeology and Historic Preservation, King County, the Port of Seattle, and the City of Seattle's Office of the Waterfront and Civic Projects. To learn more about the history of Seattle's waterfront, visit us at historylink.org.